You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Okay, slight technical difficulty. Hold on, I've screwed that up. We're gonna play this out. That is so my bad. Hello, everyone. We're starting Dear Science, the Dear Science show for today. I did accidentally just play the outro. That is so my bad, but we can just keep going. We're gonna keep going, and I'm gonna edit that later for the website if you want to listen back to this episode. Anyway, we've got a really cool show lined up today. Okay. For this segment. Sorry, hold on.
There we go.
Let me now put I'm on away. Your mic. Okay, really great start to the show. Thank you so much for tuning
Welcome
in.
Welcome 2026.
We've got we go. Professor Alan Blackman is here with us, our expert scientist. And we've also got Vihan, the producer, is also in studio. We've got some very cool topics today, and let's just get straight into them. Let's try and move past that whole total blunder.
Let's not talk about it.
Let's not talk about it. Okay, we've got awesome topics. Let's start with this first one.
Yep.
It's a new discovery about microplastics in the body, but it's a bit more positive news than it sounds. I wanted to let you talk about what they found here.
Yeah, well, very interesting, actually. So let's talk about microplastics, which was a word that probably didn't exist about 5 years ago, I would say. You know, it's a word that has had much recent interest in the media. And, you know, pretty much to the point where everyone's now heard of microplastics.
Yeah, well, they were saying, everyone's got a little bit of microplastics in their body, or, like, you're ingesting it when you're eating your food. Right. Like, that seems commonly widespread information now.
Yep, commonly accepted, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So what are microplastics to begin with, anyway? So as the name suggests, they are plastics on the micro scale. And when we talk about micro, we mean a millionth of a metre. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take a millimeter, in other words, and we all know how big a millimeter is, and then you divide that by 1,000, and that's a micrometer or a micron.
That's okay? Crazy. Okay.
So that's very, very small.
That's obviously, like nothing.
Yeah, so we're not seeing these things.
Yeah.
Okay. And as I said, even you know, this has been very, very big in the media of recent times. And as you say, you know, there's all of these reports that microplastics are now everywhere, right throughout the environment, which is probably not too surprising. I mean, the amount of plastics that we use.
Well, like, isn't it true that, like, all the plastic that's ever been made is still in existence? Like, it hasn't broken down yet?
No, I wouldn't say that's the case necessarily, because they do have biodegradable plastics.
Oh, I mean, that's good.
And you know, that's where work should go in this area. But, you know, whether it's economic or not, that's what matters anyway. So
anyway,
you know, so these things are all through the environment. And more importantly, they're supposedly all through us as well. And you'll get, you know, lots of recent media stories about the presence of microplastics in humans and the potential harm that that's doing. And so everyone is sort of up in arms about this, you know. Now, let's step back a moment. And before we ask what harm they're doing, let's ask the question, are they actually there?
Yeah.
Okay, because this is what a bunch of scientists have done very recently. So there's a recent article in The Guardian, which is not the normal place that you would pick up sort of scientific research and stuff like that. But a bunch of scientists had basically written to The Guardian saying, look, you know, you're giving these studies that say that microplastics are all through the human body, you're giving these credence by publishing them, and we're here to say, well, hang on, we don't think that the science actually that's being done here to show the presence of microplastics shows what people think that they're showing.
Yeah, right, okay. Like false positives.
Right, so there's the problem. So one of the big problems with this is that these studies are being done by non-chemists. Now, as a chemist myself, I know that if you're analyzing for anything on very, very small scales, which is what we're doing, you have to be absolutely precise in your experimental setup. You have to be able to account for every possible eventuality. And the problem with plastics is that they are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, plastics are ubiquitous. So the chance of contamination is going to be huge if you're working in an environment where plastics are already present. So if you're trying to analyze for tiny amounts of plastic in the presence of, you know, lots of plastic that potentially can screw up your results, then you've got to be doubly careful.
Right.
So that's a problem. And then the other problem, or another problem, is that plastic and fats are quite chemically similar. And in fact, they can be difficult to differentiate using the methods that people have been using to look at the presence of microplastics. Okay. So that's where you've got to be very, very careful. So you've got to be careful on the basis of contamination, and you've got to be certain that what you think you're looking at is, in fact, or what you're looking at is, you know, what you're looking at. So there was a paper published in Nature last year, which hopefully everyone knows is sort of the top journal, at the start of last year, and they were looking at the apparent increase in micro nanoplastics in human brains. Now, when we talk nanoplastics, that's an order of magnitude, well, three orders of magnitude smaller than a microplastic.
Nano. Even like
so we go to a millionth of a millimeter for nanoplastics.
That's crazy. Okay.
And so they published this paper, and they're basically saying on the basis of autopsy results from 1997 to 2024,
mm-hmm.
they're saying, oh, look, you know, we're getting this increase in microplastics in the brain over this time. Okay. And so the people who, or some of the people who wrote to The Guardian, also published a paper in Nature, sort of a reply to this, saying, whoops, hang on a minute. There's a whole lot of things that you didn't take account of in the study. So limited controls for plastic contamination and the possible false positive that you're going to get out of fat.
Okay? Yeah.
Now, the brain is 60% fat. So, again, you're looking to analyze for something that's chemically very, very, very similar to fat in the presence of a massive amount of fat.
Okay. Yeah, so they thought that we were seeing more microplastics, but it's actually good news that we're not. Or is there?
Who knows if we're not? That seems to be the problem.
They can't really work it out based on this data.
The problem appears to be the science, okay? The how it's being carried out and by whom it's being carried out, okay? So one of the people who wrote this article in Nature, sort of debunking the whole thing, they just called the paper a joke, quote unquote, which is kind of rare in science. It's fairly, you know, strong words. And they said that the serious doubts, not only about this paper, but about half of the sort of high profile papers that have been around in the literature and stuff of recent times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just faults with the experimental design and everything. So look, are they there? Are they not? I don't know. And of course, people are making money off this even as we speak, because you know, you say you've got microplastics all through your blood, and so you go online, you'll find that there's an advertisement, you can remove all the microplastics for your blood for a mere £10,000, you know. Who wouldn't want to do that? So basically, and as we say very, very often on Dear Science, more study is necessary, but more careful study is necessary. Okay,
definitely.
And so really, the jury is possibly still out on all of this. We need to take these results with perhaps a bit of a grain of salt, and let's get better data on this stuff before we start sort of implementing policies and stuff like that based on poor science.
Yeah, well,
or less than optimal science, let's say.
Speaking of...
Yeah.
Making massive claims about things that can be disproven by other scientific research.
Mm-hmm.
Your second topic is quite, I'm sure a lot of people heard last year when US President Donald Trump announced that not specifically just paracetamol, but some different, was it Tylenol or something?
Well, that's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like painkillers, when taken during pregnancy, can lead to ADHD and autism and other such things, which has been disproven by a, or at least counter...
Called into massive question.
Yes, by this meta-analysis that you've brought for us today. Yeah, let's talk about this one.
So, you know, that famous medical expert, Dr. Donald Trump, and Nobel Peace Prize owner.
Oh, my God, I saw that. That's insane.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, okay, let's not even.
As you said, in September last year, he said that Tylenol, which is the American trade name for paracetamol, as we call it, or acetaminophen, which is sort of its chemical name, quote, can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. A very increased risk. That's not even English.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It was such a big, like, he was like, oh, this is a bombshell, like, unbelievable discovery that I've just discovered. Absolutely. And everyone want to know the truth. It was so insane.
Well, people already knew the truth, but then he comes out and says this. So sadly, some people have to get put to work and actually debunk this. So there's a paper published this week that does debunk this. Surprise, surprise. So it's a meta-analysis. So a meta-analysis is when, basically, again, you take all of the existing studies in the literature, you prune out the rubbish ones, you analyze the good ones, and you see what they say on the basis of all of that. So, so this is published in the Lancet Obstetrics, so that's a, you know, pretty darn good journal, by a bunch of European researchers from Italy, the UK, Sweden, and Norway. And they took 43 studies. So these are the highest quality studies of this particular question, you know, painkillers during pregnancy. So there's been a lot of studies of this, okay? And so the number of kids studied is around about 1 million in total, okay? So we're talking...
That's a lot of evidence.
We're talking a lot of evidence here, okay? And now, importantly, poorly executed studies were chucked out, okay? They were excluded because of the poor experimental design, okay? And so, funnily enough, what they found was absolutely no link in taking or not taking paracetamol during pregnancy with respect to autism or ADHD or intellectual disability of any type.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'm glad we've finally come to that realization.
Right. Now, so where did this come from in the first place? Again, it came from poorly designed experiments, a few poorly designed experiments that didn't account for things like genetic predisposition to autism. It seems to run in families.
Yeah.
Or what the heck are the women taking paracetamol for in the first place? They're taking it for, you know, fevers and you know, infections and those sorts of things. And they can obviously have bad effects on the newborns.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
That seems blindingly obvious, but, you know, that wasn't taken account of either. So once you go critically through all of these studies and you figure out which are the goodies, you figure out which are the ones that don't have optimal experimental design, there is no link. There just isn't. And sadly, people shouldn't have had to have wasted their time doing this, but for the pronouncements of...
Yeah, well, it's got a lot of influence. Really want to call
him. Yeah, well, sadly he does.
Yeah, when he says something like that, a lot of people believe it. So.
Yes, yeah, but they don't believe the scientists. Yeah. That's the sad thing. They'll believe a politician, but they don't believe scientists.
Trust in good science. Ah, that's the message of Dear Science this week, I think.
Yeah, well said.
Yes. Our final topic on good science is this very interesting study that we're reading about horses. Yeah. And they've done – this is kind of – I don't – exactly know what the origins of this might have been or why they've chosen to pursue this topic, but it's quite interesting. They've discovered that horses can sense or smell fear people. How have they done this?
Well, when I was a kid, I was always told, you know, when there's a dog and it starts barking at you or something, oh, don't get scared, dogs can smell fear, you know, which just makes you more fearful, obviously, doesn't it? You know, got a bloody dog chasing you or you know, barking at you, and apparently that's true, you know, that dogs
so that is
can,
true
yeah, so
that,
dogs
like, I know
can
that's
smell
like quite
fear.
An urban myth.
Apparently it's the case. And so it also seems now that horses can do this too. And as you say, you know, what made somebody think, well, let's see if horses can smell fear. So obviously, you know, they're interested in dealing with horses, I think. And
well, horses seem quite sensitive to a lot of things around.
Yeah,
It seems like they would, I don't know if they'd pick up on a lot smaller things than just sound.
Well, I guess potentially, I suppose. So So what they did, they got a bunch of volunteers, 30 volunteers, and first up they all sat them down in front of a horror movie. Mm-hmm. The horror movie is called Sinister, apparently, if anybody has seen that. I have never heard of it.
Oh, yeah, it is Sinister.
And this was done in France, so it might have been a French movie. I don't know. Anyway, so they're all watching that, and they collected sweat samples from these volunteers.
That's kind of a crazy way to do it, actually.
While they're watching the horror movie.
Yeah.
And then they got the same volunteers, and they got them watching some happy joy, you know, thing and everything, and they took sweat samples from them while they're watching the happy joy thing.
Right.
And then what they did was they took 43 Welsh horses and they exposed them to these sweat samples from either the horror movie or the happy joy, or the control, in which case there was just no sweat there.
Would there not have been like a control of sweat from like just going to the gym or something, or going for a run?
Yeah, that could be sort of...
Because maybe all they can smell is just the sweat, the amount of sweat.
Well, again, there you go. That's experimental design. Yeah.
Just kidding. Oh, my God. Don't trust me. I'm not a scientist.
But what they did find was that when they exposed the horses to the sweat from the horror movie, that the horses got more skittish and jumpier, and their heart rates jumped and bloody, bloody, blah, and they were less likely to approach humans.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so that didn't happen with the control or whatever. Now, the one thing they should have done, which they didn't, was to analyze the sweat samples and find particular molecules in the sweat samples that differed. And then they could maybe, you know, narrow it down to one or a number of particular different molecules that are causing the horses or maybe that might be in their follow-up study or something like that. But this, you know, this seems to be pretty kosher. They seem to have shown that, yes, horses can smell things that are associated with fear, and that makes them seemingly fearful themselves. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. My brother was, shout out to my brother again, because he listens to Dear Science every week. He was asking if they would be able to sense, I guess they haven't done it in this study, but would they be able to sense like other emotions? Like, I don't know, like you don't sweat when you have every kind of emotion. Like, that doesn't seem like a very plausible study.
I think we're probably constantly sweating.
Is it more about the smell of the sweat, or is it more about the sense of like, I don't know how that works. Actually, I probably should read into it.
No, I think it's going to be particular molecules. I think that we do smell different when we're under stress than when we're not. And so, therefore, they can obviously sense this. And again, so can dogs, obviously. And dogs have amazing olfactory systems. They can smell way better than we can. So yeah.
And they can smell drugs at the airport.
They can.
And oranges.
Oh, that sounds like someone speaking from experience.
Really,
$400
sadly,
fine, was it?
I don't even want to talk about it. It was like 7 in the morning.
If you didn't want to talk about it, what the hell did you mention it for?
Okay, anyway, thank you so much for joining us today. That is all we have time for.
Bugger.
On Dear Science today, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Motat, and thank you, Science. I'm so sorry we don't have an outro, so we're gonna go straight into a short break, and then we'll be right back with some more interviews. Keep it on the beat.
Nice day today. Is that Alan?
Alan! 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 Alan!
The Wire.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.